Amen. This is for you guys that are visiting today. This is the most pleasant this room has ever been. So you can count your blessings this morning. I walked out on the porch and I'm like, it feels like Colorado this morning. It does not feel like it has here the last couple of days. So guys, we are in Genesis chapter 13. So if you guys want to go ahead and move in that direction, open up your Bibles. We are going to pick up where we left off last week, but I'm going to start with just a general question to ask you guys. How many of you guys have ever been pushed into a very important decision rapidly? Like, you just had to make a really important decision, and you had to make it quick. Would anybody like to share their experience with that? Bo, is that you?
Buying our house.
Okay.
It kind of came on the market and we had to hurry and snap. I mean, if anybody's bought a house lately, you've had that decision. Like, do I do it? Do I jump on it? It's not going to be here if I don't. So that's
okay. All right. Anybody else? Or any kind of decision where it just kind of jumped up at you?
I had, when I was 15, we were looking for a horse. And we went to look at this little mare. I liked her. And she's like, well, you've got to decide tonight if you want her because I have somebody else who's interested. My guess is she was probably bluffing, but we didn't know. I really did like her. Mm-hmm. And I literally had, like, less than 24 hours at 15 to make this decision on this, you know, animal that you're going to have for the next 15 years. It's not my house. But that was a huge, and it was, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I was so sick to my stomach, and yeah.
All right.
Not fun.
I hate them.
What about you're trying to leave church and cars are backed up behind you? Gotta get across the
road. Do I cram in here behind all these other people? Do I go all the way over?
Good one. Good one. Good one.
Only because we've all been there.
Anybody else? I know another one for us was when we were switching schools and with the girls, and we were coming out of White House. It was after I had switched jobs, but we had to, the girls were at Owens, but we thought we wanted to go to Cumberland, and they called us. And it was like the middle of the year, and we're like, well, I don't know. And they're like, we need to know by tomorrow. And we're like, bah! I mean, it's all of a sudden, it was like, suddenly, I mean, we're going to have to pick up that day and just make the change. And so that was stressful. That was stressful. So, anybody else? Well, tell you what, the reason I ask this is Genesis is full of lots of quick decisions that have to be made by the main characters. Sometimes the decisions are good ones, sometimes not. And I think it might be kind of instructive for us to think about not only the kind of decisions they make, but maybe how they prepare to make those decisions. So, all right, so we're going to be in chapter 13 and 14 today. Gonna be heavy on geography today, guys, just because it's those kind of chapters. So once again, a reminder of where we are. We have gone all the way through Genesis, first 11 chapters, and now we are narrowing down on God choosing a people for himself, doing that through Abraham, calling Abraham out of Babylon, where we ended in chapter 11, where he calls not only Abram, but his family up to Haran. Ran across some interesting stuff about Haran's and the father of Abram, and the fact that he died there. He died in the home of his ancestors. And as best we know, the father of Abram, Terah, actually died a pagan. The people of this region worshipped the moon god Nana, which just really makes me laugh. Every time I say Nana, it's like my... Anyway. But it was from there that Abram finally comes out, and he comes down and he has these encounters with Yahweh. part of this divine council of gods, but it's the Most High God, and we're gonna get to that concept, that El Elyon, which means the Most High God, and he has several encounters with Yahweh. He doesn't know him as Yahweh yet, but where Abram's told to go down into this area, and he tells Abram he's gonna bless him, and he tells him this is where you're gonna be. And then last week, we talked about the fact that there was a famine in the land. And the famine actually was a precursor to Abram going down into Egypt and residing there. One of the interesting things I always teach about kind of the geography and kind of how that impacts the way the people lived when I was teaching world history is that the Nile River Valley in Egypt is important because we know a lot about it. And the reason we know a lot about it is because of political stability. And the reason they have political stability is because of the geography. It is protected by deserts on both sides, which in to some degree protects them from invasions. But the other thing that protects them is it has annual flooding on the Nile that's like clockwork. And it's very, very predictable. It's not something that they have to worry about. It's annual, and it's something that their lives revolve around. And so when we talk about the ancient world, you're always talking about Egypt existing for millennia, and you've got all of these kingdoms that are incredibly stable for very, very long periods of time, as opposed to what we're going to read about today over here, which is chaos. The Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, prone to flooding. Sometimes it's regular, sometimes it's irregular. Just reading the Bible itself, how many times does famine hit? And when famine hits, a lot of time, where do they go? They go down to Egypt. They go someplace where that you don't have to worry about it as much. That also presents a lot of political chaos in this part of the world as well. And part of that is also because it is in the middle of a trade route that everybody wanted control of. So this is a crossroads of civilizations in ways that the Egyptians were not. So anyway, last week we got Abram. He goes down to Egypt. He has that episode with his wife where he says, actually, she's my sister. Pharaoh takes Sarah in, and that doesn't work out so well for Pharaoh. And then there are plagues visited on Pharaoh and his household. And he says, hey, what did you do? You lied to me. Take this woman and get out of here. And they leave, with lots of stuff. And that's kind of where we left last week. So, reminder, back to the beginning of chapter 12, what kind of promises were given to Abram? He said, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I'll show you. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great, so you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. And him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So go and leave your father's house, making you a great nation, making your name great, as opposed to Babel, where the people were trying to make their own name great, and making you a blessing. And that's one of the most important concepts for us to constantly remember about what is the promise. The promise isn't just Yahweh wants a people for himself. He wants a people for himself so that people can be a blessing to the whole world, not just the Israelites. So their function is to be a blessing. That is why they are there. It's not just so that they can be happy, okay? It's so that they are a blessing to others, okay? All right, so chapter 13. So if you want to follow along with me, let's do this. Let's go ahead and read the passage all together, and then we'll come back and unpack it a little bit. So if you guys will help me out this morning, can somebody read verses 1 through 5 for me? Anybody, anybody? All right, you got it, Megan. 6 through 10. Who wants 6 through 10? You got it? 11 through 15. 11 through 15? All right, and then 16 through 18. All right, Sean. All right, let's go.
Place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and also had flocks and herds and pens.
And the land could not support both of them. While living together for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdmen from Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanites and the Perizzites were living in the land at the time. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are relatives. Is the entire land not before you? Please separate from me. If you choose the left, then I will go to the right, or if you choose the right, then I will go to the left." Lot raised his eyes and saw all the vicinity of the Jordan, and that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the Garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, going towards Zora.
So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked, sinning greatly against the Lord. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, "Look around from where you are, to the north and to the south, to the east and west. All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring can also be counted. Arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you." So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord.
Okay. All right. So, a couple of things. We'll start with this. If you go back to the beginning of 13, and it says in verse 2, "Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold." Does anybody have a translation that says something a little different there? Instead of saying it was rich in. Does anybody have anything different?
What was the verse?
Verse 2. 13:2.
It just says wealthy.
Wealthy?
Just rich.
Okay, so here's what's fascinating about this. Once again, one of those things lost on us because we don't speak Hebrew. The word there for rich is kabed. Kabed is a primitive root that means to be heavy in a bad sense. It is the same word that was used in chapter 12 when it said that famine was heavy in the land. So it was, the famine was kabed. Whenever Abram left and went to Egypt, but when he comes back, Abram is chabed with riches. Now, that could mean a couple of things. It could mean in a good sense. It could mean in a bad sense. We actually, I think, brought that up last week when it says that Abram was blessed coming back out with lots of stuff. And I think one of the more interesting things, it's the stuff that he has when he leaves with. One of those things is going to be Egyptian slaves, which is going to be a problem eventually. And we'll get to that later on. So Abram comes out. Once again, it's a reminder, Abram is like a chieftain. He's not like wandering around by himself. We're talking about a very, very large clan that would have been traveling with him. And we see that. I mean, we get into this passage here where he and his nephews, I mean, they've got so much stuff that he and his nephew's people are fighting over territory. And these folks are shepherds. They graze their animals. And basically, they have a problem in the land where, you know, their folks are getting crossways with one another. So here's what gets really interesting. So starting in verse 9, it says, is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I'll go to the right. Or if you take the right, I'll go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities in the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Okay, so a couple of things. First off, I got to give you guys a little bit of background on some more geography. Okay, if I were to pull a map out this morning, put it up on the board, which direction would be up?
North.
North, okay? That is because in the Western tradition, that is how we have oriented ourselves, and partly because of the post-Enlightenment era, we see north as up because of the spinning globe and all this kind of stuff, okay? In the ancient Near East, up was east, okay? So when they would have oriented their maps, they would have viewed east as being up, okay? So here's what's going...
Where down to Egypt means they were going west.
Yes, yes. So, well, and the other thing about to the west was water, the Mediterranean and chaos, okay? So, so here's what's fascinating. So Abram takes Lot, and he basically is near Bethel, which is the place we talked about last week, and he was facing east, okay? So as he's facing that way, he tells him, you can go to the left, you can go to the right. You go to the right, I'll go left. You go left, I'll go right. So basically, he was giving Lot this opportunity to, and we'll look at the map here, make some decisions about where he wanted to go. Now, the land of Canaan that Abram had been promised at this point, where basically the Lord told him, you know, this is where your people can be. Are you guys okay? This is actually blowing pretty hard now. Does it feel okay? Okay, as long as everybody's good. It's like blowing pretty hard. So what's happening is we're down in this area here, Bethel, okay? They're looking this way, okay? So what he says is to the left or the right. What Lot sees is east. He doesn't look to the left or the right. He looks this way. And in fact, he looks down in this way, okay? Now, a couple of reminders about east. Have we seen things gone east before? What is to the east? What's the first mention of east we get in Genesis? Eden. What happened when they were expelled? They were expelled where? To the east. Where is Babel? Where is Babylon compared to Canaan? To the east, okay? There is this idea that east is not necessarily where it's a good place to be, okay? And that's certainly kind of insinuated here, okay? Because what Abram was given was this area, not this area. Now, to be sure, Abram said, okay, if that's what you want, fine. By the way, how does Lot describe the land of the east? Well, first off, what does it say? He did what? He saw. Have we heard that before? Okay, it's the same language from Genesis chapter 1, 2 and 3, where it says Adam and Eve saw. Okay, remember, God sees and declares, as opposed to people see and declare. So Lot saw. So that's not a mistake with the language. The language there is very purposeful. He saw it, and how did he describe it? What are the words he used to describe it? Well watered.
Like the Garden of Eden.
What is that?
Eden.
It's like Eden, right? It was well watered, that kind of thing. And by the way, it is, because what you're talking about is this Jordan River Valley. Now, once again, a couple of things about the geography of this place. I was telling Bo this morning, I think my trip to Israel several years ago, if it's done anything to me, it's really made me much more aware of the geography and how important it is to the storylines, because I've always kind of had the storylines in my head, but it was like it might as well have been Middle Earth or, I don't know, Narnia as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, seeing all these places, these are real places. You can go to these places. You can take pictures of these places. And so when you look down, you are literally looking down into this Jordan River Valley, and it is well watered. And that's the other crazy thing about Israel is you can go from one area to another, and within 10 miles, you go from an area that's fairly lush to an area that's extremely barren within just a very, very short, area, which in Texas is so weird for us because we drive for eons and see nothing but pine trees, right? So he looks that way. And he says, okay, that's what you want, that's what you get. That's going to be really important later on. Because later on, whenever the Israelites come back out of Egypt and they come back into the land, the Lord tells them, don't mess with this over here. This over here doesn't belong to you. You're going to see the descendants of Lot and Esau later on, and that territory is going to be attributed to them. So the Lord literally says to Moses and Joshua as they're coming in, I didn't give you that. That's for those people. So the Lord literally honors this deal that Lot and Abram made with one another, which is kind of fascinating. And it's going to, once again, all this stuff is really important when we start moving into the rest of the text. And by the way, remember, one of our problems with reading Scripture is we read it with a microscope. We read this one little passage and we don't realize, oh my goodness, this comes back. Remember, this is like the greatest epic ever written, okay? So for you guys that are into fantasy literature or these long novels, I mean, this is what's going on, because somebody that's familiar with Exodus will go, oh yeah, that's why God said you can't go to this place, because it's connected to what happened all the way back over here in chapter 13. So this is a connection here.
I'm sorry if I'm being dense.
No. Nope.
But this is kind of like flipping my head upside down. So basically the idea was Canaan was given to them, mm-hmm. and Abram said, you can go this way or that way. And he's like, nah, I want to go that way. And mm-hmm. so he was literally choosing what was outside of what God had purposed for them in the first
place. Or at least for Abram.
Okay, for Abram. Okay.
Because remember, he said, this is for you and your people. Now, if he had given that land to Lot, mm-hmm. what do you think? What if he, I mean, would that have been okay?
I think when it's like totally, and this is like, I just feel so silly, but it's like going back to third grade Sunday school, as I was always taught, well, there was the good land and the bad land, and Lot mm-hmm. was greedy and took the good land and kicked Abraham into mm-hmm. the rocky ground, and that was it. But it wasn't even, he wasn't even choosing something that was Abraham's to choose according to God's.
Mm-mm.
That's interesting.
Mm-mm. And it wasn't like bad land, good land.
And that, but that's what we were always, I mean,
right.
We taught that. I was like, you took the green stuff and left the rocks to Abraham.
Right, right. And which is not really the case. And in fact, the area that we're eventually going to get to when we start talking about this area down here, I liked it up here. When we visited down here, this was an unpleasant experience, okay? This area down here is rocky, wilderness, hot. I mean, this whole Dead Sea area right there. And tar pits, we're going to get to that later on. I mean, there's a lot of weirdness going on down there, just geographically. But yeah, now here's the thing. If Abram had allowed Lot to live there, would that have been okay? Why, Sean? It was his to give. Lot, okay, now here's the other fascinating thing about this. Abram's been given a promise. Who is Lot to Abram at this point? He's the closest thing to an heir he has. This is the other thing, and this is one of those things that people, that I think it's lost on us. Abram had been promised he was going to be made a nation. He's getting on up there in years. He already knows that, right? Sarah is getting on up there in years. He already knows that, right? In his mind, he's probably thinking, well, we're probably talking about Lot at this point, okay? Because it's his nephew. If he has to adopt him in, that's what he'll do, okay? So in some ways, this is really Abram letting go, if you think about it. And by the way, I think in God's providence, this is Abram letting Lot go out of the land, if you think about it. So that's kind of the way, when I think of it, this is kind of a providential way for God to continue to do his purpose in the life of Abram. Abram's being faithful in that sense, in saying, okay, now by the way, it won't be the last time Abram doesn't take matters into his own hands and try to make things happen, but this is at least something that, obviously, you know, what happens right after this? I mean, what's the next thing that happens as soon as Lot's gone? And what does God say?
He says, now, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, north, south, east, and west. For all the land you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever.
So God's not upset that he let Lot go. And in fact, it's almost like a stamp of approval.
It felt like to me that like this. this was when Abram finally did all the things that God told him to do in the beginning. When he said, leave your family, he didn't mean bring them with you. I think this is when he finally...
That's a really good point.
And then God met him.
So, that's a really good point. So the reason I started with that question today, have you ever been, you know, forced into a hard decision? Abram was forced into a hard decision here, right? And he made the right choice. And by the way, it was a righteous choice. Because here's the thing, Abram was also the elder. He didn't have to give Lot a choice. He could have told Lot where to go. But he actually gave him the option, which is kind of fascinating as well. It's kind of one of those interesting things. So, this is one of those times when Abram, in faith, makes a good choice. He lets go, probably of the fear. And by the way, most bad choices we make are usually made what? Out of fear. When we take matters into our own hands, sometimes it's because of fear. I think anytime we come back to that, you're going to see that a lot with Abram, right? So they part ways. God then tells him, okay, here's the land. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Whenever it said that, let's look over in verse 15. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever, and I'll make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. That's going to be important later on, because we're going to have some other analogies that are made to his descendants. This one has to do with numbers. I'm going to make your numbers uncountable, is basically what he's telling him there, okay? But then he says, arise, walk about the land through its length and its breadth, for I will give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent, came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So this is another altar. Remember we talked last week about having those spiritual markers, that it's good to have those, okay? So Abram, once again, he built something to remind him of what happened there. It's another altar, okay? And what's also interesting about this, much of Genesis, and we're going to see this later on, we're going to see this with the covenant on Mount Sinai with the Israelites. What we have here is called a Surizan treaty, okay? These are ancient Near Eastern treaties, and there's kind of two types. There's treaties, and then there's land grants. A treaty is between a king and a vassal, and the way that worked is basically, it's to protect the king, honestly, because basically if you violate the treaty, then you get cursed on one side or the other, and that's kind of how a treaty works. A land grant is literally a blessing to the recipient who gets the land. And to kind of come around to a description of how this is, verified, is when the land grant is verified, you walk it. And it'd be kind of like signing a contract today. Once you buy something, once you buy a house, once you buy whatever, you walk the perimeter to see where it is. And this is literally God saying, walk the perimeter. Okay, this is what I've given to you. So it follows in the tradition of a lot of Near Eastern contracts that we see in these ancient times through Ugaritic texts and stuff like that. So it very much follows in the tradition of things that you would have seen at that time, except this is literally granted by God, not a king. So that's kind of cool.
I'm not a Bible expert, so you may have to dumb this down for me, but... what about all the other people that were living there? I mean, they just came in and just...
Yep.
I mean, you know, it's kind of
yep.
Like...
Okay.
We're gonna
get into this, okay? Because one of the things that we moderns deal with is just the whole principle of fairness, okay? So the folks that lived there were Canaanites. There were people living in that land, and we're about to get into that. What we're going to see is that God, Yahweh, literally starts to apportion this territory for one people group. And he doesn't expel all of them. He expels the ones that are specifically problematic. And in fact, there's going to be some interesting times when he says, hey, don't fight them. Their evil hasn't reached fruition yet, but it will. And then you're going to go expel them too. So we're going to come back to that. We're going to see a lot of that. You see more of this in Joshua. in the conquest period. But absolutely, the land's filled with people, all sorts of interesting people. And we're going to talk about some of those. So it's a great question, and it's one of those that we as moderns struggle with in ways that they wouldn't have. So, all right. So, speaking of real places, places you can go to today. Where did it say he finally settled? At the Oaks of Mamre. Okay, so are the Terebinths. Some of your translations may have said Terebinths at Mamre. So there is a Orthodox monastery, actually an Orthodox cathedral there at the Oaks of Mamre today. This is in Hebron. It's actually in the West Bank, which is part of the territory that's governed not by Israel but by the Palestinian Authority. But you've got this church there, and you've got, this is what's kind of cool. So you can go, you know, if you can get in, and you can go see Abraham's oak, okay? Now, is this the actual oak that he was at? Probably not, but there's a really, 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 really old oak that for at least several hundred years, everybody says, yes, that's Abraham's oak, and it fell over a couple of years ago. And in fact, you can see they've set structures up around it, try to hold it up. But there is a smaller bud that's come up from one of the roots that they're trying to keep alive at this point. So that's kind of cool. So it's one of those places you can. Yes, it's very old. Not Abraham old, but it's really old. And, you know, like with anything else, the early church built a church there. And that church has been there for a really long time. Because you have these associations. So is it in the general region? Probably so. And remember, oaks, trees. Remember, once again, themes. These trees were associated not only with pagan cults, but you would have also had this associated with visitations from God. Oaks of Mamre are going to be really important later on. Not just because he settled there, because we are going to have another visitation as we keep moving through into Genesis. All right, so let's go to 14. Now, 14 gets really interesting. So here's what I'm going to do with 14. I'm actually going to I've got a video, okay? I have found this to be much more helpful than us reading it, because this is one of those passages that if you were probably reading it on your own, you'd just start going, words, 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 big words, can't say that, don't know that, words, 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 words. And you'd get through to the end and you'd be like, okay, that made no sense to me at all. So here's what we're going to do. I found a video, and I'm going to play it, and it's a map describing what's going on as you're reading this chapter. And I think it might be really helpful for you guys. I don't have my little Israel map, otherwise I would point as we're going. But anyway, so I'm going to play this. It's about 2 minutes long, so bear with it. But I think it'll help it make sense to you. One of the places it's talking about here, once again, it's one of those places you can go. There's an area called the King's Highway. And the King's Highway literally is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, running through modern-day Jordan. You can go there. I got online and found lots of Westerners who've traveled the King's Highway. And the King's Highway is an ancient, ancient road system, once again, connecting trade routes that ran through this area going back to ancient, ancient times. And so if you've ever seen the pictures of Petra, have you guys ever seen Petra? Is like, I think it was in one of the Indiana Jones movies. It's basically this. It's carved into rock. It's like a cave, but they've like carved all these surfaces on the outside, that kind of thing. All that stuff is in and along the King's Highway. So anyway, I'm gonna play the video, and then we'll unpack it a little bit. Hopefully, this will work.
Genesis 14. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And all these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Sheva-Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites, who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their provisions, and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said,
Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand.
And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram,
Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself.
But Abram said to the king of Sodom,
I have lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share.
All right. Okay. Names. Lots of names. Lots of kings. Lots of places. Okay. Okay. So here's what I wanted you guys to see.
Genesis 14.
Yep. Hold up. Here's what I wanted you guys to see. Basically, what you had four kings that came from the north. Okay. This is one of those things, it's kind of one of those great kind of mysteries of history. We still don't really know who these folks were. We've had a hard time connecting these folks to actual other extra-biblical resources to find out who they were and why they were there, that kind of thing. The names are somewhat common, but we haven't been able to specifically connect them to specific kingdoms. Now, here's the thing you need to understand. All these kings it's talking about, these are probably city-state kings. This is how Mesopotamia worked. You had a city-state, and that was what you had. It was a city with a king. That's how it worked. Also with a local deity. It's only at various times and places that you have the development of an empire. An empire is a collection of city-states, like the Babylonian Empire, which we see multiple examples at. The Egyptian empires or dynasties, though that's very different, okay? So what you're seeing here is conquest amongst these folks up here, specifically, and I still can't say the name of Shelah Amar, somebody. That guy was using these guys as vassals. So they were probably paying tribute. And at some point, these folks said, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. And that's what led to war. So these guys come down the King's Highway, and they attack several folks in these different regions. They end up going and fighting the kings of Sodom down here. And the reason this is a story, it might not even be included, but Abram gets caught up in this, specifically because Lot gets caught up in this. Lot chose, right? Lot chose poorly, okay? Lot chose to go down here to an area that's going to end up getting Abram involved in all of this. So they go down here, they have all this fighting. The fighting goes down into the Negev, comes back around, and then they take off. And once they take off, that is when some folks come to Abram, who's been camped out down here in Hebron. And he basically says, look, they've got Lot, they've got other people. What do you want to do? So Abram rousts troops, only a little over 300, which is actually at that time not a large group, which could also speak to this whole idea of small numbers being used by God against large numbers. And so he goes up, but it was a night raid. It was kind of described as kind of a nighttime raid. He goes, he gets Lot, rescues him, comes back, and then we have this really interesting exchange between the king of Sodom down here, but also this Melchizedek. And we're not even going to try to get into that today. We're going to come back to Melchizedek later. But I did want to, I wanted to look at a couple of other things that are super, super interesting. One of them is the Rephaim. Okay? So everybody, let's back up. Let's look at chapter 14 a little bit more closely. Because in chapter 14, one of the first things it talks about, if we look at chapter 14, verse 5. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim and in Zuzim and Ham and in Emim and Sheva. Anyway, all right, Rephaim. Is that a word we've heard before? We haven't. This is the first time we hear this particular term used, but it's all throughout the rest of the Old Testament. Okay? Now, Rephaim is a term that's used to mean two different things in Hebrew. Okay? One of them is the dead, okay, or shades. In ancient Hebrew kind of cosmology and theology, the idea is that when you died, you went down to Hades. You could call it bosom of Abraham, whatever you want to call it. But basically, you went down as a shade, and you were in darkness and in Hades, and you waited. That's where you went, okay? The Rephaim, that is a term that's used to denote that. Specifically, there was also this term to denote this idea of these quasi-divine dead kings, okay, or these fighters, okay? The other way that it's used is as a giant. Rephaim was a term that was used to mean giants, okay? Now, we've already talked, and this is all connected back to Genesis chapter 5 and 6 with the Nephilim, okay? Once again, back to our weird Bible, right? So lest you think that's the only place that that kind of weirdness shows up, oh no, okay? The Rephaim and the giants continue to show up. Now, if I'm talking about giants in the Bible, where's the first place you go to? Goliath, David and Goliath, right? Now, guys, that's much, much later in the storyline. This is 1,000 years later, okay? We're talking about very, very early. So the question I've always had is, where'd Goliath come from? Why is there a giant still running around? What's that about? So here's the thing. If you want to find out about Rephaim, a good place to go is Numbers 13. So we've got time. So bebop on over there real quick. I want you guys to see this. This is kind of cool. We get reference. And by the way, just real quick, can you guys think of any other places where giants show up aside from Goliath? Think of all the other biblical stories. Is there any other places where they say they see giants?
When they're going to the Promised Land?
Yeah. When Joshua and Caleb, they go into the Promised Land and they scout it out. And they're like, those folks are there's giants over there. You know, that kind of thing. It's like, that's once again one of those weird things. Okay. So so let's go to Numbers and looking at Numbers 13. And I will read this for you guys real quick. And it says, starting in verse 25, when they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation, the sons of Israel, in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh, and they brought back word of them to show all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent it, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and the side of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, hey, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it were men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So that's another one of those passages, until I really kind of started digging down into this, I assumed Nephilim, you only get referenced back in Genesis. But this is basically saying this is those descendants, okay? So real quick, let's back up. What was the understanding of Nephilim in that Second Temple kind of early stages of the church, the time of Jesus? How did they view this stuff? The way they viewed Nephilim was this. You had Elohims, these divine beings, came down to the daughters of men, and they had children. Those children were Nephilim. These were these quasi-divine things, right? But this was all before the flood. So there's a couple of questions here. It's like, okay, so the flood happens. Didn't everything get wiped out? Okay? So there's two ways of approaching this, and what might they be? You guys tell me. How do we reconcile the fact that the flood happens, but there's still these giants roaming around?
Flood everything.
Okay. It could have been a local flood or universal flood, not a global flood. So there's that. Anything else?
They came back to the daughters of men. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who's to say this didn't start over again? By the way, we see this idea in pagan occultic practices in the ancient Near East. We've talked about this before. Even up into Jesus' time, you had temple prostitutes, right? The temple prostitute, having sex was literally part of the worship services, to go in and have sex with these temple prostitutes. Well, part of the practices were that literally you called down the god to inhabit the priest or priestess so that when... basically, you're asking them to be possessed when they have sex with a person. And that's kind of the idea, okay? So this was a practice that was really common. And the progeny of this, at least at that time, was claimed to have been this, all right? These giants. So you can look at it either way. Either way, this is several instances now. And by the way, the words that are used oftentimes, sometimes it's Rephaim. In other places... jump over to Deuteronomy. This is another interesting spot where it talks about these Rephaim. So in Deuteronomy 2:10, it says, and this is also talking about coming into the land, in 10, the Emim lived there, formerly a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim, but the Moabites called them Emim. The Horites formerly lived in Seir. The sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. So that's another instance there. So you get down to 2:19. And when you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass them nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given that to the sons of Lot. Remember, that's that spot there. Remember, that's Lot's, okay? And then down in 20, it is regarded as the land of the Rephaim, for Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumin. And then going down to Deuteronomy 3, one of the most famous of the giants is King Og of Bashan. And this is in Deuteronomy 3, 8 through 11. So thus we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. Sidonians called Hermon Sirion, and the Amorites called it Senir. All of the cities of the tableland, all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Salica and Idri, cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnants of the Rephaim. Behold, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. In it is Rabbah of the sons of Ammon. Its length was 9 cubits, its width 4 cubits by ordinary cubit. So this King Og of Bashan, it describes his bed. Guess what they found? They have found ancient ziggurats with a bed of this size. Most likely considered a religious cultic bed that would have been used by temple prostitutes and by that dude, whoever that dude was, right? So anyway, so other cool things here. So this is Hebrew. Rephaim is a Hebrew term, and that Hebrew term, in the Old Testament, we've got really the oldest version of the Old Testament we have is called the Septuagint. It's in Greek. Okay, so you've got Hebrew and you've got Greek. The Old Testament oldest copies we have were actually in Greek, and the Greek is much much more nuanced and much more specific in its language. So we've got this Septuagint version of the Old Testament. We've got this Hebrew version of the Old Testament. What's fascinating about Rephaim in the Greek Septuagint and the way that it's translated is it uses the word gigantus, which is where we get gigantic from or giant from, but titanon, okay? Does that sound familiar for anybody that's familiar with Greek mythology? The Titans, okay? So, which has its own Greek mythological take on this. So there's literally this crossover of these quasi semi-divine kind of creatures that were products of the gods and women. And I mean, okay, if you are familiar at all with any Greek mythology, that's all Zeus did is go down and rape women, pretty much. That's kind of his thing, right? And we see that over and over again. And then what's the progeny of that? You've got things like Hercules, these kind of demigods, right? Same thing, okay? So, all right, what do we do with all that? Well, here's the thing that I would like to think about all of this is that, number one, this goes back to your question. About the people living there, okay? Who were these people? They were these people. It were these people, okay? These people that were products of stuff that shouldn't have happened. And it's another one of those things. Here, and this is really where I've been for the last 2 years, realizing just how much of this stuff in the modern world we want to be dismissive of. What does this mean? Let's spiritualize these giants. What is, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, no. If we want to take the Bible seriously, we have to take it seriously. Does it mean what it says? And what it says, and if you're trying to understand it within this context, is that there were giants. Is this a theme we're going to see over and over again? The theme you should remember is that these are folks who are making claim to a territory that Yahweh says doesn't belong to them. They're also making claims to activities that Yahweh had prohibited. Remember, we are part of Yahweh's story, but Yahweh's story's a big story, okay? It's cosmic warfare. What's going on here is we're in the middle of this massive battle in heaven that's going on between those that have rebelled against Yahweh and those that are still, you know, loyal to Yahweh. And we are part of that story, okay? But make no mistake, we're caught in the crossfire between these two groups. And giants were a way for these rebellious Elohim to circumvent what they thought should be happening on earth as opposed to what Yahweh thought should be happening on earth. And it was an affront to Yahweh because Yahweh is going to bless humanity in ways that the other Elohim would not. Remember, Yahweh is manifested as Jesus. He is human, right? Not like this. This was something that was prohibited from the other Elohim. They weren't allowed to do this. And so what we see over and over and over again is God using his people and others to drive these folks out. They're called giant clans, to basically get rid of these giant clans that are still around. By the way, and when they don't kill them all, guess what? They pop back up, right? Most fascinating, many of these giant clans, the ones that don't get wiped out, they settle where? In a place called Gaza. You ever heard of that? The Gaza Strip. It's this little sliver of Israel. If we're looking at it today, the Gaza Strip is down here, okay? It's actually a fairly lush region, okay? Today it's controlled by a terrorist organization called Hamas. It's where most of the fighting's been taking place in Israel most recently. Well, guess where those giant clans settled? They settled in Gaza. So later on, we see David fighting Goliath of Gath or Gath. Where was he from? The giants at this time get associated with the Philistines. So the Philistines later on are going to still have remnants of these Raphaim, these gigantes, these titans, these people from the old, right? So when it comes to decisions, I like how Abram at this point, so he made two good decisions in this one. He let Lot go, and when it came time to fight, Abram was ready to go. Notice, he did not pause, he did not wait, he didn't worry about it, he didn't take an overwhelming force, he just went. He went and he did the fighting. As opposed to what we see with the Israelites later on. He did not make his decisions out of fear. Not only that, I love, and we're going to save this for next time because we can't get into Melchizedek today. I don't know how long we're going to have to unpack Melchizedek. But when he comes back, he has this interaction with Melchizedek, but also this other king. And this king's like, hey, you know, keep this and I'll take this. And Abram's like, this has nothing to do with you. This has nothing to do with you, right? And it truly didn't. It didn't have anything to do with him. Okay, so what do we learn from Abram? He prepared himself, I think, ahead of time to make some of these decisions. I think he was ready to make these decisions when they came upon him. And we kind of have to know what we believe before we get into those situations, right? We have to make sure that we don't make those decisions based on fear. And that theme of facing off against giants, that small force against a large force, overwhelming strength versus weakness. Is that not Yahweh's way over and over? I mean, think of all of these kingdoms around there. He could have, I don't know, sent somebody to Babylon and said, hey, I'm going to turn the Babylon Empire into Yahweh's empire. No, he's like, I'm going to take this one little guy. Take this one little guy, I'm going to pull him over to this one little area, and I'm going to do this one little thing. And then I'm going to bless the whole world that way. And oh, by the way, I'm going to do it through suffering and death. You know, it's so like God to do it that way. So anyway, let me pray for you guys. Father in heaven, thank you so much for these stories left to us. Thank you for Abram's faith. Thank you that we can take both good and bad lessons from Abram, for reminding us that that he wasn't perfect, and certainly we aren't either. So, Father, I pray for everybody in this room that's facing a Rephaim this week. I pray for everyone here who has a giant they need to face, that they need courage in going up against. Remind them that the battle is yours, that we can't do any of these things on our own, that we need your participation in our lives in such a way that you could fight those battles for us. Father, help us this week to be grateful, as some of us might have a day off tomorrow for Memorial Day, to thank those that have sacrificed for us, that we might live in the plenty and the blessings that we have in this country. Father, we love you, we thank you, and we praise you. And I pray all these things in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right. You guys have a great week. Enjoy that weather out there today.